That's music of George Crumb. An excerpt from the haunting 1979 work Apparition, and a movement entitled The Night in Silence Under Many a Star. Performed by Cordless, a voice and piano duo breathing new life into new and forgotten music. Cordless is Sarah Lemesh, soprano, and Allegra Chapman, piano, both of whom are passionate about exploring overlooked composers and contemporary music, creating innovative experiences for ways that audiences can discover new music. Soprano Sarah Lemesh's most recent triumph was with Pocket Opera in March of 2020, where she sang Zerlina in Mozart's Don Giovanni. Opera Wire praised, quote, her coy, seductive manner as well as her vocal energy. She's also been seen, heard, and praised in recent West Edge opera productions, and on the art, song, and chamber music front has premiered numerous works at festivals throughout the country. Welcome to you, Sarah.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Pianist Allegra Chapman also joins us. She recently joined the award-winning Delphi Trio as their new pianist. She is also a co-founder and artistic director of Bard Music West, a San Francisco music festival that explores the worlds of composers from the past 100 years. She performs regularly with leading Bay Area ensembles, including the Left Coast San Francisco Chamber Music Players and Earplay, among others. Welcome to you, Allegra.
Thanks, David.
Sure. I think it's fortunate that you guys got some of this production stuff done before the crisis started. But let's first talk about this musical happening that's going to be happening tomorrow evening, actually late afternoon, which we just heard a little bit of a taste at our opening. So The Night in Silence Under Many a Star. Tell us about the inception of it first and then the actual event.
Yes. So we decided to actually create the music video in the fall of 2019. We had performed this piece almost in its entirety at Bard Music West two seasons ago. And this was our favorite movement that we had performed. And while we were discussing producing a music video, this was around September, October of last fall, we had essentially recently founded Cordless. That happened officially in January of 2019. And we just naturally gravitated towards this piece because we had such wonderful experiences performing it live. And we knew it would be extra special to record because there's unique freedoms in recording a piece like this. We can experiment with dynamics, and it's quite abstract and allowed for a lot of liberal interpretation ideas in a video format.
And it also gives you a chance to showcase what you both consider your forte, so to speak, the combinations of storytelling, digital media, contemporary music, a rarity in this George Crumb work. I've never heard of it. A way to collaborate and some exploring at the same time.
Absolutely. It's been a really incredible piece for us to both explore together. And adding the music video element to it has just really brought a whole new dimension to our understanding of the piece for both of us.
Mm-hmm. The text is taken by from Walt Whitman's work. What work is it taken from?
It's taken from an elegiac poem called When Lilacs in the Dooryard Bloomed, I believe, which is a very long poem, and Crumb actually excerpts various parts from the text that he uses scattered throughout Apparition, the full work. And it was written by Whitman at the end of the Civil War, as really right after Abraham Lincoln had been assassinated. It wasn't taken, but a lot of people. So it's about acceptance of in various ways right now.
Sure. Sarah, I'm going to, Allegra, I'm going to ask you to chime out for a moment and give us a call here at the studio so we can get a better audio connection. And meanwhile, I'll talk with, you can leave your connection here for our video. The wonders of Zoom, ladies and gentlemen, and live radio, it's all dependent on everyone's technology at once. So give us a call. I'll give you the number, Allegra. Look in chat. Niels will communicate that number and we'll get that started. And Sarah will continue with you, and perhaps you can share with us the locations that were chosen in Marin for the video.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll just chime in case people didn't get part of what Allegra was saying. The original poem is really a reflection upon the death and assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And obviously we had no way of predicting the interesting relevance of that kind of piece that explores grief and mourning. We had filmed it in Mill Valley just 2 weeks before the official shelter in place orders were given in the Bay Area. And we find it interesting now to explore themes of collective grief, since it's something we're not really able to do in person. So this poem and film actually provides an interesting outlet. But yeah, we hope that people will actually recognize some of the locations that we filmed at. It was all local. It was in Mill Valley. We actually rented an Airbnb at a lovely home in Mill Valley in the hills. And we filmed near the Dipsy Trail, and then also near a public park, Old Mill Park, actually, near downtown Mill Valley. And we also went to Muir Beach, and we went to that. We accessed the Muir Beach Trail right near the Pelican Inn. So it's totally local, and it's kind of like our own mini love story to the Bay Area.
I guess so. I will certainly enjoy that. Some of those locations are very familiar to me as well. So talk a little bit about the creative team that's been working with you.
Sure. So obviously, Allegra and myself, we founded Cordless initially, and the first person we knew we wanted to collaborate with was Joseph Dwyer. He is an independent filmmaker based in Los Angeles, and both Joseph and I attended Rice University, but interestingly enough, even though we overlapped by a year, we didn't meet at the school. My fiance is friends with Joe and introduced us. So I contacted Joe in the fall, and then we spoke together with Allegra. And Joe is such a, interestingly enough, he's never filmed a music video before, but he worked at Harvard where he would film classical music concerts when he lived in Boston, where he did his graduate studies in film. So he has such an innate understanding of what live performance is in the classical world. And then we worked with Matt Carr, who is an amazing sound engineer based in the Bay Area, who Allegra has worked with. I met him through Allegra through Barb Music West because he recorded past seasons. So it's a really lovely team it's just been a joy to work with everybody.
I think we have Allegra back now. Anything you want to add to that about the team, Allegra?
That pretty much covers it. I hope my connection is slightly better.
It is. You're much less robotic now, but I'm enjoying someone's dog in the background.
Oh, yeah, that would be my dog. I'm dealing with so many different types of challenges around technology.
Oh,
with
please, people. Don't get me started on that front.
Right.
So this is going to be much more than just tune in and watch this video when it comes out. You're going to have some announcements. You're going to have some Q&A afterwards with an audience chiming in.
Yeah, so we've set this up actually to be a webinar, but kind of a participatory webinar on Zoom. So we'll have a screening of the video at the top of the event, and then we're going to do a panel discussion moderated by the incredible Kate McKinney, who is a manager of communications at San Francisco Ballet. And then we'll open up the floor to Q&A time for all of the participants. And we'll take questions from people, and people can also come on live, kind of on stage with us if they'd like to ask in person. So we're really looking forward to being able to actually have a conversation with everyone who comes.
Right. And to register, you can go, there's a link at cordlessduo.com, is it?
Yep. That's right.
And we'll have a link, of course, at our website as well on Open Air and some information about the event. What else is in the pike, given our very awkward situation in the performing arts right now?
Sarah, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, sure. You mean with cordless specifically?
Sure, or personally.
Yeah. Well,
imagine a lot of canceled performances and things that still have to be recreated.
Unfortunately.
Right.
Yeah. Sadly, like many other performers, both Allegra and I have had numerous cancellations. And this video, again, the timing is very serendipitous in many ways. While we're very fortunate to have even filmed at all, we are exploring different ways to continue to collaborate as a duo by doing remote recording projects and creating films. We've actually been discussing commissioning and applying for particular grants when possible, but commissioning a video that's animated, for example. So we're exploring different ways to share our art. And while things are at a standstill right now, I think Allegra and I are both optimists at the end of the day. And I think there are opera companies, for example, like Heartbeat Opera, based in New York City, that are finding ways to share art, even via Zoom. So we're all just trying to learn as quickly as we can about these different digital platforms and how we can still use them to our best advantage, despite the inherent challenges.
Indeed. How about you, Allegra?
So I'm really excited by the ideas that Sarah and I have been percolating. And my trio, Delphi Trio, is also coming up with several different projects that we'll be able to perform, even if we can't be in the same location necessarily. And I'm practicing a lot myself and thinking about different things that I might do during this kind of very extended down period. I think I'm trying to look at it from a positive side of things and look at the opportunities that that are presented by having all of this empty time and time to really be creative and come up with new ideas and spend time at home practicing or not.
Indeed.
<That's often> the case.
It is a challenge as a musician myself, finding the motivation and the more creative ways to not only nurture your soul, but to nurture your career at this point. And we'll follow yours carefully at cordlessduo.com. And in the meantime, let's hear a little bit more of a taste of the George Crumb that you can hear starting at 5 p.m. You can register through cordlessduo.com for some fascinating music of George Crumb, text by Walt Whitman, and a tour of some hot spots in Marin. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Coming up, a timely tale of paranoia and surveillance and the world radio premiere of Panopticon by Aaron Loeb and Peter Robinson with some reviews. Stay with us. Music of George Crumb and unusual techniques on the piano being performed by the duo Cordless Duo. Cordless Duo is pianist Allegra Chapman and soprano Sarah Lemesh. CordlessDuo.com for registration for that video unveiling and discussion tomorrow evening. And you'll enjoy quite a tour of Marin as well. This is Open Air on KALW. an excerpt from the soundtrack of the movie Belgravia. From the creators of Downton Abbey, Peter Robinson here to discuss that film as well as the police thriller In the Line of Duty, and he'll have a book review for us. Welcome back, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to be here. And just talking about being at home to start with, if you've been watching or streaming different types of movies or video, top of my choice this week has been the BBC original Belgravia. It's written by Julian Fellowes, who's famous for Downton Abbey. And in this particular story, he goes back a century. So the opening scene is in Brussels. It's on the eve of the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. And Sophia Trenchard is a fresh-faced young daughter of a tradesman. But she has fallen in love with Lord Edmund Bellis's son, who is a major leading aristocrat. So this is a story about class, it's a story about property, and above all, it's a story about strong female relationships. In Downton Abbey, there were the three sisters, each competing for a different part of the estate. In this one, we have two elderly, strong female actresses playing lords and ladies and Mr. and Mrs., and they are worried about this relationship between a daughter of a tradesman falling in love with a top aristocrat. So that's the background of a really interesting six-part series that takes you through Victorian England. It's like the last hurrah, the twilight of empire. And the dialogue is really what is most engaging. The characters come to life, and the story as it develops, as a country moves from agrarian to industrialization, from middle class to upper class, and then back to middle class again. A story about chasing love, about the wealth of matrimony, but it also includes gambling and all the other vices in between. So if you're looking for something which definitely is British, definitely is Julian Fellowes, and definitely is in the spirit of Downton Abbey, but a century earlier, you will enjoy Belgravia. Belgravia, incidentally, is that part of London where the upper class live, but indeed it may be high up, but they have dark secrets. And revealing that secret is the pitch that Fellowes picks up. The period drama, I think, has a relevance today because it does show how different families operate. It's a family drama, great acting, a riveting story, and it's in the hands of a great storyteller. Julian Fellowes has pulled off, I think, another piece of well worth viewing if you are at home and glued to the screen. Now, my second choice is a totally different type of drama. It's a police investigation drama, and the precise title, in case you're looking for it, is Line of Duty. Some people are confused it with In the Line of Duty. It's Line of Duty. It first started on BBC Two, and then 2 years ago, in 2017, they switched to BBC One, and they couldn't get enough viewers. They had 10 million tuning in on the first series. Part of this is the wonderful script of Jeb McClure. It's a police investigation. It's got dense dialogue. It's a whip-smart pace, a complex squad, a totally complex plot about a squad of police officers, and it really demands viewers' attention as it deals with corruption. In a sense, it's less about capturing criminals and more about looking inside about the moral dilemmas of a contemporary police investigation group. The scripts are smart, they're clever, they're complex, and they will really keep you waiting for the end of each series because he knows how to finish an episode with a cliffhanger. A couple of words about the story. The unit known as AC-12 is an investigation unit looking at internal crimes amongst the police. And in many sense, it's a drama which I think gets you to ask questions, moral questions. Are we all corrupt? Do we all take bribes? Do we all have something to hide? And this is why I think as a blockbuster, it got many viewers who may not normally follow police dramas totally engaged.
A timely film as well, Peter, given our times right now.
Yeah, and so it's going into its fifth series. When I spoke to my friends at the BBC, they did say have a sixth one in the planning. It got postponed because of the virus. But I think start at the beginning and then work your way through. Each series has six episodes, and you'll just want to know that great feeling about television drama, what is happening next. So I think three reasons for going there. I think first and foremost, it's an incredibly surprising investigation scenes. Secondly, you will definitely get hooked. And thirdly, the dialogue is witty. It's very funny. So by way of contrast, if you want to finally get up off the couch, my last is a book recommendation called In Praise of Walking. And walking is something I've been doing a lot of these days. It's by Sean O'Mara. It's a real book about the neuroscience of walking. Shane O'Mara is a neuroscientist. He teaches at the University of Dublin. But he believes that walking makes you healthier, happier, and here we go, brainier. And for him, one of life's great horrors is waiting for permission to cross the road. He always wants to keep on the move. So he takes us through some urban landscapes, an epic journey across London, another journey around Oxford where he did his DPhil, and then he waxes lyrically about Dublin. But above all, he's interested in the connection between the foot and the brain. So this is as much a neuroscience story as it is about pacing around. And when walking rhythmically, he looks at the way walking has engaged some famous people. You know, take, for example, Bertrand Russell. He gives a good example of how Russell really believed that walking was the key to his thinking. He also cites from T.S. Eliot in Love Song of Alfred J. Prufrock, in which how walking helped him think through poems. Walking became a creative act. And in my own experience, many years ago, I did a broadcast based on the author of Pieces Every Step, the Buddhist monk Thich Mahant. And we walked around Berkeley, and I was hoping to get an interview. Throughout the whole walk, he never said anything. And I was suddenly faced with that dilemma. You're walking with a spiritual person where, for him, silence is golden, except on the radio. So if you're looking for a book to get you off the couch, onto the streets, into the countryside, down and across what parks are ever open at the moment, pick up a copy of Shane O'Mara's In Praise of Walking, and you'll have plenty to think about, but you'll also begin to see the connection between the foot and the brain, between urban landscapes and country landscapes, between nature and yourself. And then as you step out into the great unknown, you'll find out there was much more to walking than putting on a pair of running shoes. Make sure your shoes are comfy. Off you go into the great outdoors. And here in the Bay Area, in Marin, in the East Bay, there are some beautiful places to be seen. You'll see them better if you travel on foot.
Thank you, Peter Robinson. Some great reviews for your indoor and outdoor pleasure. The series Belgravia from the creators of Downton Abbey and the police thriller In the Line of Duty. And as always, we are all in praise of walking these days. A book by Shane O'Mara. A very good afternoon to you. I'm David LaTulipe. You're listening to Open Air, our weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. Next, it's our new initiative that we're continuing here on Open Air called Corona Radio Theater, offering live drama as part of Open Air and letting actors do what they do best, act. This is a world premiere of a new short play by Aaron Loeb, who has a parallel career as a video game executive. He's playwright in residence at SF Playhouse, and I'm pleased to welcome back the co-founders of the Playhouse, Susie Damolano and Bill English, to our Theater of the Airwaves as they perform Panopticon. A couple sits at a table, a bland breakfast in front of them. She is bored. He is unhappy. This is the state of things, and it is clear, has been for some time. Perhaps he reads a paper. Perhaps she reads a book. They do not look at each other unless they must. This is a very nonchalant breakfast conversation.
I've poisoned your coffee.
He looks at his coffee cup. He very deliberately picks up the cup and drinks his coffee, a long, slurping drink.
You'll see.
Oh, can't wait. Death would be a welcome change.
You don't believe me.
I've been watching you. You didn't poison my coffee.
You can't watch me all the time.
I do. All the time.
I pre-made your coffee last night when you were asleep and weren't watching. I'd poured in an ounce of Drano, spit in it for good measure, microwaved it this morning, served it to you, and now you've drunk it. I poisoned your coffee.
I switched them.
When? I've been looking this whole time waiting for you to drink.
You weren't when I switched them.
She lifts her coffee cup, doesn't drink. She smells it, puts it down.
You didn't switch them.
How do you know?
I know what Drano smells like, and I definitely know what my own spit smells like, living with it as I have all my life. You didn't switch them.
Perhaps, but whether I did or not is immaterial. You didn't poison my coffee.
I did.
I have cameras all around the house, hidden cameras that you don't know about. There's one in a book over there, another behind that grate. In the kitchen, I have a camera hanging from the pot rack that looks like a frying pan, but it's a camera, you see? And every morning before you wake up, I play back the video tracking your nocturnal life like a meerkat on that show.
Meerkats are diurnal.
Be that as it may. I keep a journal of your little nightly triumphs, like the time you get a jar of pickles open all by yourself. I jot down all your small catastrophes, like the time you couldn't find your car keys. I maintain a record of your life more complete than your own memory, so that when you tell me one morning I don't remember where my car keys are, I can say they're on your dresser, and thus keep the conversation to an absolute minimum. I know more about you than you do, and I can tell you for certain you did not poison my coffee.
I knew about all that, about the cameras.
Right.
I've always known.
Mm-hmm.
I hired a body double.
Really? Clever.
She comes in after you've gone to sleep, snoring like an idiot. She is my height, my weight, my hair color, my nose. In short, me, only an actress. While she spends her nights acting for your cameras, I'm out of the house purchasing Drano to poison your coffee and dancing until dawn with gigolos at Tony nightclubs like the Golden Swan and the Fancy Flamingo. I am popular, beloved. I have hangers-on. At the clubs, everyone calls me Carmen, and they think I am the widow of a rich oil man whose name is Ricardo. You see, I can be dangerous and exciting.
You don't look like a Carmen.
To them, to the gigolos and the hangers-on, to them, I do.
I've seen the video. Neither you or your actress body double put anything in my coffee.
I switched the tape.
We've already established that you did not know about the tape.
We have only established that you don't think I knew about the tape, but let's suppose I did.
No, I never suppose anything.
But I insist. Let us suppose that I, being aware that you are watching me all the time, devised the following plan. You fall asleep. I take a tape from a previous day. Let's call that day yesterday. I sneak out. I purchase a book entitled How to Poison Your Husband's Coffee with Drano. A good book. A very useful and good book. Then I dance at the Tawny Tiger with a 20-year-old Speedo model. Woo-hoo! I sneak back in at dawn, place a cup in the microwave containing the following: coffee, Drano, and a soup con of unnecessary but very satisfying spit. I sneak into your secret video surveillance room, which I have always known about, by the way, ever since it was just your secret room for the observation of pornography.
Never.
I switch the tape from last night with the tape from the night before and go to bed. You wake up, go to your secret monitors, and watch my body dump double, triumphing over a jar of pickles. You wake me up as you usually do, demanding breakfast. I prepare it. You watch. Everything is normal, but for one small detail. When I put your cup in the microwave, there's an exact duplicate there already. It is the duplicate I remove and place before you, the one that is there. Right now, it is not by way of coincidence, but by way of meticulous planning on my part. Poisoned. Let's just suppose.
He drinks his coffee again.
And where is she in all this?
She?
Your double, the actress?
What? I don't know.
Well, do you think she'd like me? That we could be friends?
I doubt it. Perhaps. Why does it matter?
Well, I'll be a widower soon. Perhaps I'll change my name to Ricardo.
Ah, back to this.
Your coffee is poisoned.
You didn't switch them, and besides, I didn't drink any.
You will.
Why would I?
You know, the better question is, why haven't you already? Because despite all your bravado, you aren't really sure I didn't switch them. But when, any moment now, I keel over vomiting Drano, you'll be certain I was lying about switching them and you will drink. Oh, yes, you will drink.
I have been watching you this whole time.
But you haven't been watching the coffee.
You may have video cameras and tapes, but I have insomnia and vigilance. I know for a fact that you have not touched my coffee. I have followed you around the house from the moment I pulled this cup out of the microwave. This poisoned cup right here. Ha! Yes, that's right. I said, ha!
You only think that you've been watching me.
And what do you suppose you mean by that?
Well, let's imagine all of the events in the universe, improbable or otherwise, that could yield the net result that we will call I have poisoned your coffee, where I is me and your coffee is that cup in front of you. If we've been honest, most of the scenarios ending in this result are ones that you could not directly observe. I mean, surely by now you realize that despite your considerable self-regard, you were not, in fact, omnipresent.
Take that back.
Perhaps I might illuminate for you the series of events that will result in your untimely death.
I'd like that very much. Thank you.
Our scenario begins with our hero, me, realizing that the woman on my tapes is an actress.
How could you tell?
She walks differently. I fell in love with your awkward gait. No actress, no matter how talented, could properly reproduce your sort of loping.
Loping like a she-wolf.
If you must. Now I, having realized that you, my she-wolf wife, have gnawed your way out of my video camera net, come to the conclusion that you are planning my demise. And so I enact the following plan. I put an ad in the paper for a professional double.
That's where I found mine.
Newspapers are totally underrated since the advent of the internet.
I know, right?
2 days after placing the ad, I receive a call from a man, an Iraqi, who recently fled his country with 20 years of experience. He was Saddam Hussein's body double. Now, interesting, I tell him, people often remark on my resemblance to Saddam Hussein. He laughs and he says, I hope the resemblance is only physical. Saddam Hussein was a serious poop goblin.
He said that?
He said that. That's how they talk in Iraq. I confirm for him that I am not, in fact, a poop goblin, and this appeased him. Okay then, dude, he says, we gonna do this thing or what?
They don't say gonna do this thing in Iraq.
He learned it from our troops. May I continue with my story?
Please.
So, I hire the man. How can I not? Having been Saddam Hussein's double, he is trained in the ways of assassination, including the application and survival of poisons. One day, let's call it this morning, Faux Saddam, who is now faux me, wakes you up for breakfast. You make his morning coffee and then follow him around the house, making sure he doesn't poison you in return. He does not. But while you are following him, I, the real me, mind you, creep into the kitchen and place a radioactive isotope in your coffee. Bloop. So you see, I don't switch the coffee cups. You were right about that. But I do separately poison yours.
And when do you switch places with Mini Saddam?
That's the genius part. I don't. I am, in fact, the Saddam Hussein body double. And over the past 20 years, I've built up an immunity to Drano. The book you bought was originally released in Iraq under the title, How to Poison Your Dictator's Coffee with Drano. And since then, Saddam, being a paranoid poop goblin, required all of his body doubles to taste test his coffee for him.
None of that is true.
Prove it.
I can't.
Exactly.
She raises her coffee cup and takes a deep drink.
I told you so.
No, you told me I would only drink once I saw you on the floor vomiting Drano. You are actually quite surprised that I just drank this coffee.
I confess I am. Why did you do that? Your husband put a radioactive isotope in it.
I'm not really me. I am actually my double as well.
No.
And over the years that I have been creeping around this household in the middle of the night looking at your pictures, I have fallen madly in love with you and your Saddam Hussein-esque good looks.
Oh, how tragic.
But now that I know you're the kind of man who would slip a radioactive isotope into his wife's coffee, I don't want to live anymore.
Oh, no.
Why do you say how tragic and oh, no? I thought you wanted me dead. Or at least the real you wanted to kill the real me. Surely an identical actress will approximate.
Because, you see, I've known about the actress for some time now. I've been afraid you would have her, or more accurately, she would have you harm me in my sleep. Actually, to put it correctly, harm him in his sleep. And so he assigned his double, me, to watch her double, you. Over the months, watching her, you, glide through the house late at night, not at all like Wolf. I fell madly in love with her, you. Can't you, she, see? I have the same Saddam Hussein-esque good looks, but he am a better man than I could ever be. I would never put a radioisotope in her coffee. You, she, and he really could have had something together. Something magical. And now you're going to die because you drank the radioactive isotope. And so am I.
You too? I thought you were immune to Drano.
I made that up just so you would drink the coffee. We will both die by the other's hand.
How tragic.
I know, right?
Let me suggest something.
Oh, I'd love to hear anything that you would suggest.
Perhaps we might embrace as lovers do.
Sounds self-indulgent.
No, bear with me. It's for a reason. Don't you suppose that when those two find us, their exact duplicate body doubles, dead in each other's arms, it might wake them up to the horrors of their behavior? Perhaps he'll stop watching her all the time. Perhaps she'll stop sneaking out and snorting coke off the abs of 18-year-olds.
She does that?
Doesn't matter. What I am suggesting is, perhaps they will see the positive and loving message of this double homicide. Maybe seeing that we too have fallen in love will make them remember how they once loved each other, really loved each other.
They did, didn't they?
Oh my, yes.
All right, we're gonna do this thing.
You and your charming Iraqi patois.
They both rise. Slowly, they approach to embrace. She pauses.
Wait. How do I know you're really poisoned? How do I know this isn't all another trick?
You don't. And neither do I. Isn't it romantic? It's like Saddam once told me, sometimes murdering someone is just like love. Unless you do it with your hands, you just have to take it on faith.
He had a beautiful way with words.
They kiss. Slowly, each of them reaches behind the other, grabbing a steak knife from the table. Each raises their knife, about to strike. Suddenly, she pulls away, and both hide their knives behind their backs. She stares into his eyes.
What is it?
Nothing.
I planted a car bomb.
She places her finger on his lips.
Shh. Shut up and kiss me.
They kiss again, this time more passionately. Each drops their knife, dedicating themselves to nothing but the kiss. Susie D'Amelano and Bill English in the premiere radio performance of Panopticon by Aaron Loeb, presented as part of Open Air's Corona Radio Theater. I'm David Lotulip. I hope you enjoyed that, and I'm pleased to welcome back with their actors' face paint taken off and ready for the post-interview of Corona Radio Theater, both Susie and Bill. Fantastic work, folks.
Oh, thank you.
David, none of this would be nearly as interesting without you reading what you do, because you just have such a great mystery radio voice. I love that you're doing these on the air.
You set the tone, man.
Well, you make it all happen, too. That's for sure. So, hey, this Aaron Loeb guy, you're a playwright in residence. How is that working out now in this time of sheltering in place?
Oh, well, you know, we have Aaron, you know, we produced three of his plays. Our first world premiere was written by Aaron Loeb. And then we did a first person shooter. And then a year later, we did Abraham Lincoln's Big Gay Dance Party that won the first prize at the New York Fringe when we took it there. And then a couple years later, we did Ideation, which also we also took to New York and had an off-Broadway run at the 59 Theater. And we currently, Aaron is writing a new play for us called The Pitch, which is kind of about a morality tale that takes place inside the world of venture capital. And we've had a couple of drafts and a couple of readings of it. And one of the things that's super important to us is that during our sort of downtime when we can't actually produce theater, our new play development, we'll be going ahead full blast with like 12 playwrights that are under commission and plays that are in various stages of development that we'll be continuing to do readings and workshops of into the next year.
Nice. Now, this playwright I'm familiar with from several of the works at SF Playhouse, Aaron Loeb. I remember distinctly the wonderful 2014-15 season, which included Promises, Promises, as well as Ideation, which was quite a bold statement as well.
Well, Ideation was sort of like the picture postcard perfect play development, experience, because we did a reading of it in our Monday night reading series, and then we did a workshop of it, and then we produced it in our Sandbox series of new plays, which is, you know, stripped down in a small theater with minimal set, minimal designs. And then the next year, then it won the Will Glickman Award for Best Play. And then the next year we did it on the main stage. And then the next year we moved it to off-Broadway. So as far as the pipeline of what's possible to do with a brand new play, it's kind of like a perfect score.
Poster model.
Yeah, poster play. Yeah.
One of the fun behind-the-scenes story is that we originally did it in our Sandbox series, which is when we do world premieres in a theater space less than 100 seats. And when we did it there, prior to opening, Aaron said, "I don't know why this isn't on your main stage. Why don't you put it on your main stage?" And I said, "Look, Aaron, if this does well or if it sells out, then we'll put it on the main stage." Well, lo and behold, it sold out every single performance. Then it was on the main stage. And I think a year prior A year prior to ideation going on the main stage, we had taken another show named Bauer by Lauren Gunderson to New York off Broadway. And Aaron said, why haven't you taken ideation off Broadway? And I said, well, if it sells out on the main stage, then we'll take it to New York. Well, lo and behold, it sold out on the main stage. So we packed our bags and headed to New York with it.
Give folks a reminder of what the plot line of Ideation. It had wonderful twists to it.
It's basically about a group of consultants, like Bain, McKittrick level, $10,000 an hour consultants that are brought into a conference room in some very generic and undisclosed place to solve the problem, how to get rid of a lot of bodies. And they assume they're being that the government wants to have a contingency plan for how to, in case a dirty bomb goes off in St. Louis or an outbreak of some terrible virus in Chicago. And they start working on the problem, but about 10 minutes into it, they start to wonder who they're actually working for. And so I call it a whiteboard thriller because these kind of heady geniuses spend the rest of the play trying to figure out using mathematical equations who it is they're working for and trying to solve a moral problem with mathematics. And it's actually a very thrilling play and at the same time, hilarious. So it's a terrific play.
And talk about timely now. Imagine if we had it as part of this season.
Well, it would be ridiculously timely and unfortunately timely.
Indeed. So Panopticon had its debut as part of the Sandbox series as well. Is that correct?
No. There's a company called Playground, which I'm sure you're familiar with. They do on Monday, they do a whole season where they invite writers to submit 10-minute plays. And this one was part of that. I believe Aaron has long been part of Playground. And he told you what the theme of Playground was the night that he wrote Panoptica, right? And why?
Oh, yeah, I have that. He couldn't make it, but he sent me some notes. But I also wanted to give another plug for Playground because First Person Shooter, our first world premiere, was a Playground commission. They did these 10-minute plays, and then they eventually commissioned the playwrights that write the 10-minute plays. And so here's what Aaron had to say about Panopticon. The Playground, every week, they assign a pool of playwrights to write a 10-minute play, and there's always a theme. And this week, the play revolved around Bishop Berkeley, who some of you may know was a philosopher, who among other things, he believed that the world that we exist and the world exists because we are being observed by God, which made me think of Jeremy Bentham, who invented the panopticon. A panopticon is actually a type of guard tower that is put in the center of a prison so that the guards can keep their eyes on the prisoners who can't see the guards or where the guards are looking. So the prisoners have to assume that the guards can always see them at all times, which then made Aaron think that Berkeley's theory that all loving God shows his love by watching us at all times. And a panopticon could be boiled down to surveillance equals love.
Wow. that is both heady and prescient.
Yeah. Aaron is one smart cookie.
He is indeed. Well, we'll look forward to more of his work. It's an amazing how this play combines shelter in place, paranoia, surveillance, the challenge that in general that couples face, let alone being in time of pandemic.
Oh, yeah. We've had breakfast conversations and all that different. Why are you looking at me that way? Why are you looking at me like that?
Especially my she-wolf loping tendencies.
we're going to have a Drano intervention at your apartment there.
Well, we purposefully don't own any Drano.
Smart. Very smart.
Drano be banned.
Well, it sounds like you guys are surviving, if not thriving, in these times. How is the rest of the family of SF Playhouse on the actors' front doing these days?
On the actors' front, it's brutal because the actors aren't able to do any acting except for, well, there's a lot of readings and people are getting really creative. And last night we actually had dinner cooked by an incredible actress, Cindy Goldfield. She's just started a catering company with her boyfriend called Martha's Avenue that makes Italian food that I think my Noni's Italian food was the best Italian food of my life. And this stuff makes me feel like my Noni is here. So it's really good. But as far as our actual company, we've been staying in touch. We have online Zoom happy hours every Friday, which we used to do in-house anyway. And everyone's keeping their spirits up and always ready to get the green light to get back on the stage.
It's the challenge ahead for most of us. And it's amazing, the creative spirit that is coming out of actors, musicians, those in the arts, making some lemonade out of the lemons that we're being offered these days.
Exactly.
And you two keep brewing yourself. We'll have you on again soon and for an update.
So good to hear and actually see you, David.
And to see you folks again. Keep up with the happenings at SF Playhouse, where you can learn about what they're anticipating to do, and you can support SF Playhouse, sfplayhouse.org. Thanks again for coming on. Cheers.
Thank you.
This has been Open Air here on KLW. A number of larger organizations are making plans for the future. I just received in the mail the SF Symphony's season brochure, kind of a surprise, but it's nice to plan, and let's see what they are planning on. One of the things that they are doing in the month of June is releasing a recording on San Francisco Symphony Media of the recording of Michael Tilson Thomas's own From the Diary of Anne Frank and Meditations on Rilke. That release will be next month in June. On the Rilke, the narrator is, the singer is Sasha Cook and Ryan McKinney, both good friends of the maestro and wonderful performers that I've seen on the stage with the San Francisco Symphony. From the Diary of Anne Frank, Michael Tilson Thomas's works on Anne Frank's diary, Isabel Leonard is the narrator, who we heard in performance back in January of, recorded in November of 2018 and in January of this year. But let's have a little sample from the Diary of Anne Frank in part 3, which is called Dear Kitty.
I wonder if it's because I haven't been able to poke my nose outdoors for so long that I've become so crazy for everything to do with nature. I can perfectly well remember when the sky, birds, moonlight, flowers could never have kept me spellbound. That's changed since I've been here. Nearly every morning I go to the attic where Peter works to blow the stuffy air from my lungs. From my favorite spot on the floor, I look up at the blue sky and the bare chestnut tree on whose branches little raindrops glisten like silver. And at the seagulls as they glide on the wind. As long as this exists, and I may live to see it, this sunshine, these cloudless skies, while this lasts, I cannot be unhappy. The sun is shining, the sky is deep blue, there's a lovely breeze, and I'm longing, so longing for everything. To talk, for freedom, for friends, to be alone. And I do so long to cry. I feel as if I'm going to burst. And I know that it would get better with crying, but I can't. I'm restless. I go from one room to the other, breathe through the crack of a closed window, feel my heart beating as if it's saying, "Can't you satisfy my longings at last?"
Dear Kitty, Isabel Leonard narrating, the wonderful, beautiful writing and orchestration of Michael Tilson Thomas, from the diary of Anne Frank, someone who knew a little something about sheltering in place, don't you think? Please be well out there. Keep in touch with us here at KLW. I'm David at KALW.org. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing Open Air. If you've got a segment selection, again, keep in touch with me by sending me an email, david@kalw.org. Our shows are archived at our website, kalw.org. It's there you can support our efforts here at Local Public Radio, keeping you both entertained and informed. Thank you.